You're listening to the Intercoastal Podcast, part of the Destination Marketing Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Intercoastal Podcast. I'm Daquan Mickens, and for today's episode, we'll be talking to Lydia Beeson, the owner of Island Indigo. How are you doing today, Lydia?
Just great. Thank you. It's another beautiful day in Beaufort.
Yes, and I'm glad to have you on the podcast and glad to have you in studio and ready to talk about your business and, more importantly, talk about you and your story. So kind of beginning with your story, let's talk about your Beaufort story. How did you get to Beaufort, move to Beaufort, and what sealed the deal to you moving to Beaufort?
Well, my husband was 31 years Air Force, so they moved us around a lot. And his last station of duty was in Kansas. But when it came time for retirement, we said, well, 10 years before that, we said, where do we want to retire? And we started looking and we decided early on we wanted to be in the Southeast. My father was a military pilot, so I grew up mostly in the Southeast. And we knew we wanted it to be coastal. We wanted a small town with a lot of charm. We wanted mild climate and maybe a college town. So there's a little bit of activity and some youth. We wanted strong history and education. I was a teacher for 27 years, so I wanted to keep learning and keep growing. And we were impressed with the OLLIE program here. That's Osher Lifelong Learning Institute that USCB handles here for older people to continue learning. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to be near military bases and personnel so we could take advantage of the commissary and the PX and the hospitals and such. So we started looking and we ended up saying, okay, we don't want to be as far south as Florida and we don't want to be too far north. We don't want snow shovels or any of that. So maybe between Savannah and Charleston, but we did not want that large of a city, just access to those if we wanted to go to the theater or different bigger events. So we narrowed it down, Charleston to Savannah, and decided that we would end up in Bluffton. And then when we were 2 years out from retirement, we came to look for a house, and Bluffton had grown so much that we said, this is a little too busy. We needed a little quieter, a little more rural feel. And the realtor said, I think you need to go to Beaufort. So we visited Beaufort and fell in love with it. And we've been here almost nine years now, and we just love it.
Yeah, it's really cool to hear that you knew exactly what you wanted, and you described Beaufort to a T pretty much. Like, you wanted coastal, in between Beaufort, Savannah, but you didn't know exactly where. And then Beaufort fits that small town, quaint, nice type of place that you were actually looking for. It's really cool to hear that.
Yes, it's been a perfect fit for us. We just couldn't be any happier.
Yes. How did you become so passionate about dyeing indigo design in general?
It's kind of a long story, but I come from a family of artists, but most of them are paint and draw and quilt and things like that. Mm-hmm. I have always loved art, and I have a degree in art history because I didn't think I was good enough to major in art. But I'm fascinated by it. So I got a degree, and one of my degrees is art history. But when I, after being diagnosed with a brain tumor and brain cancer, and I had multiple surgeries, then I was no longer allowed to work or drive. And I lost a lot of physical and cognitive abilities. So I was at home just waiting, trying to figure out, what do I do with my life? I can't work. I can't drive. I'm kind of stuck in this house and no more golf, tennis, those kinds of things. What can I do? And my physical therapist said, what did you used to do that you could still do? And I said, well, I loved art, but I'm not that great at it. I enjoy it. So for cognitive and physical therapy, I started doing more and more and more dying because I was able to pick it up and put it down whenever I felt good enough. I could work a short time or a long time on it. And it was great for the therapies that I needed. But when I had dyed enough and given away enough textiles to every friend and family member I knew, eventually my family had an intervention and said, you need some help. You can't just keep dying and making mountains, piles of this stuff. You have to sell it. And I said, I don't want to sell it. I can't handle the math anymore. I can't run a business. I can't be counted on to have good brain days and good physical days to sit in a shop. So our youngest daughter said, I have a plan, Mom. At the time, she was working on her master's. She had a degree in communications, and she was working on a master's in technology and social media and digital promotions. And so she said, we're supposed to make up a company for my master's degree and make the business cards, make up a name, and go through all the motions. And she said, how about if we make this an Indigo business, your business, for real? And she said, I'll handle all the social media and posts on Facebook and Instagram and all that. And then you, all you have to do is create. Dad will deliver to shops, and I'll do all the social media, and we'll handle everything, and you just get to create, and then we'll give you enough money from sales to restock your supplies, and the rest we'll donate to brain cancer research. So that's what we do, and it's worked beautifully for me. My husband's been great with helping, and my daughter is fabulous doing, besides her full-time jobs. Now she is a wonderful assistant for the social media and handling Instagram, and she handles the Etsy shop as well. So I don't do any of that. All I do is get to create, and it's a wonderful joy and wonderful therapy.
Yeah, Lydia, that's such a beautiful statement. And, you know, just to tell your story and for everyone to know, you know, how did you become in that position to begin with?
I was diagnosed with, I was perfectly healthy, 45-year-old, teaching school full-time, and just the kids just grown and gone. And my husband said, you need to see a doctor. You're not quite you. And I said, no, I'm fine. I'm just extremely tired, but we're getting older. And I kind of had a low-grade headache, not even enough to say, do I need some Tylenol or Advil, or no, I'm okay. It's just a little bit of a headache. I was becoming a little bit forgetful, but nothing major. I talked to family and friends and said, oh, you know, I get in the next room and I think, what did I come in here for? And they said, well, that's normal. We all do that all the time. But my husband was really concerned that something was not right. And he insisted I see a physician. So when I went in, I did finally go to my doctor and say, well, I'm tired and I'm a little bit forgetful and I have a little tiny bit of a headache. And she said, well, let's do a brain scan. I said, wait a minute, you know, let's not go overboard. I'm fine. So they did a CAT scan and then they said, well, you must have moved. So you need to do, we need an MRI. So we did an MRI and they said, yeah, you have a brain tumor in the third ventricle that's blocking cerebral spinal fluid from bathing the brain in fluid. And so your brain's drying out and you're not thinking well or functioning right. So they looked at that and they said, yeah, it's in a really bad location. It's kind of the middle of your brain and it's really inoperable. It's so close to the brain stem that it would probably kill you to get it out. So my husband and I are both a little bit, or maybe a whole lot, stubborn. And so we talked to brain tumor boards at 7 major centers, the big brain centers all across America. And the tumor boards all looked at the MRI and they all said, yeah, it's probably not removable. So you know, you'll just get worse and it'll be over. But eventually, the chief neurosurgeon at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota said, yeah, I can handle this. And with all the respect in the world, I think pilots, fighter pilots like my father and neurosurgeons have to have this ego that I can do anything. I'm in control and I can handle this. You definitely wouldn't want a little meek, mild afraid of their shadow person like me doing those kind of jobs because I'd be second guessing everything. But he said, yeah, I think I can handle this. I mean, you're going to die either way. So let me have a shot at it. And I went in for the first surgery and it was wonderful. He got the tumor out, the blockage out, but it had grown into the brain stem. So that's in there and that's growing and they can't remove that. But it was good. So they sent me home and I planned to, I had it done in the summer so I could go back to teaching in the fall. And I was home about a month and then started vomiting profusely, repeatedly for days. And eventually I was going downhill physically and mentally. So my husband eventually carried me into the ER and I couldn't walk. I couldn't talk. I couldn't respond. And they said, well, just put her in rest home. She's done. You know, there's nothing we can do about it. I was in the hospital there about 30 days and getting worse and worse. And then they said, well, we can't keep her in the hospital because we can't fix her. So take her somewhere else. And so he took me back to Mayo at that point. And they said, yeah, we need to do surgery right now, but we're not sure there's enough left of her to make it worth it. So there was a discussion with the a team, my neuro team, which was 8 or 9 neurosurgeons, and they decided to go ahead and try it. So the first time they had cut off the back of my head to get into where the tumor was, and this time they needed, what had happened was I had hydrocephalus. I had some debris probably from the surgery that had clogged another spot in the brain. And so I wasn't getting the cerebral spinal fluid moving. So they decided to drill a hole in the top of my head. And often with this, they'll put in a tube that will drain from the brain down into the abdomen. But I was so sick at this point, and I'm very allergic and sensitive to all kinds of things. And they said, yeah, your body will probably reject that plastic and different things. So they did what was at the time a new surgery. It's called a third ventriculostomy. And they basically just drilled out my skull and then they used kind of like an awl. They described it as to poke holes in the third ventricle. And because I was so sick, those holes, they hoped, would not heal closed. They would heal but stay open, so the cerebral spinal fluid and gravity would just take that naturally down. So that's what I have, is a hole in my head. And you know, people say, yeah, I think she has a hole in her head. I do. So but it drains naturally and it has worked very well for 15 years now. Each year I go back for my scan and they look at it and they say, yeah, you shouldn't be alive. And I say, but I'm still here. So by the time I was out of the hospital after that second surgery, I was down about 80 pounds. I was paralyzed on the right side. That surgery, or actually not the surgery, but the 30 days of not having my brain fed correctly, wiped out all memories. So I have no true memories of anything before the surgery. And I have pictures and I have what people tell me about the past, but I don't have a real memory like you might have of Christmas or when your children were born or any of that. So I had to relearn. I had no speech. So I had 9 therapists. They weren't going to admit me to the Mayo Brain and Spinal Rehab Unit, because you have to qualify. You have to be good enough that they think they can actually rehab you. But you can't be too good, or you're not worth the time to go in, and you can't be too bad. They thought I was too bad. So they weren't going to let me in. My husband, a military man, went in and said, you know, you need to look at that survey again and make sure the numbers work. So they checked again and they said, okay, we're going to let you in here. So I went to brain and spinal rehab, lived in that hospital, and had 9 different therapists. I can't even name them all, but a cognitive therapist, a speech therapist, a physical therapists, recreational therapists, all kinds of things. So they taught me, basically I was an infant in a woman's body, and I had to re-memorize or relearn everything. Some things I did not relearn, they finally gave up. I can't crawl, for example, that's above my brain level, but I could never master the walker when they got me out of the wheelchair and tried to teach me to walk. I could never figure out the walker. It just ran away from me. So I see people with walkers and I'm like, they don't know how smart they are that they can run that thing, because mine ran away from me. But eventually I learned to walk. I can't walk a straight line. Weave around a little bit because my vestibular system is damaged, so my mobility is a little off, but I do walk, and obviously I've learned to talk. My vocabulary is limited, but I work on that daily. So that's where I came from, and where I am today. There, you know, a lot of things I can't do. I try to focus on what I can do. People ask me what's the worst thing, and the worst thing is losing my keys, my independence. Yeah. I have friends and family who are great to take me a lot of places, but I'm not very good about asking. And I would love to just be able to just go and do on the spur of the moment, but it all has to be planned and scheduled and have someone else take care of it for me. And I don't want to be a burden to all these people. Nah. So my rehab process was interesting too. After I got out of the hospital, they finally decided that I would be able to go home if I had 24/7 care. So one of our sons was playing semi-pro baseball and his season had just ended. So he, bless his heart, he came home and my husband switched to working nights. And then my son worked the opposite schedule, and they took care of me, each took a shift taking care of me and giving me all the medicine. At that point, I was in the wheelchair, paralyzed. They put on the bib and they had to feed me with a spoon, you know, open your mouth and whatever. I couldn't do anything for myself. So it was really wonderful timing that he was able to come and willing to come. And he was so patient with me in teaching me all the things that really an infant or toddler needs to be taught or told. So it's an interesting experience. And I tell people it wasn't fun relearning everything, trying to relearn, but it was fascinating because I had the flashcards in therapy where I learned this is a cat and this is a dog and this is a tree and whatever, this is blue. But when I got out into the world and I saw the neighbors, what I thought was a cat, they said, oh no, that's a dog. And I was like, it's small, it's furry, it's the same. And so then I said, okay, that's a dog, that's a cat. And then I said, oh, look at that cat. And my husband said, it's not a cat, that's a squirrel. Oh, well, it's a little furry, it has bushy tail, it's climbing the tree. So figuring out all the different animals and all the different colors, we did primary colors in therapy, but we didn't do purple or that there are a zillion shades of green or all those things. I just knew the very basics. So learning, you know, my husband would say, do you want a pen? And then I couldn't figure out the difference. Well, why is this a pen and this one's a pencil and this is a Sharpie and this is a highlighter and this is there's so many things to learn in this world and it is fascinating. And I thank God for Google, because I don't know what people with brain damage did before that to relearn about the world. But I make lists every day of things I need to Google or things I want to learn about and new things. So somebody will mention the Bay of Pigs and I'm thinking, what is that? Then I have to go Google and find out all about the world. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, that's an amazing story to see how, you know, you took something, a situation where, you know, all hope was lost and bleak, and you took that and now you're a business owner and, you know, you sell different garments and accessories and clothing of indigo that you've dyed personally. I think that's an amazing story. And, you know, seeing how passionate you are about the indigo and your dyeing and taking that in the brain cancer awareness, it's just an amazing story that you can tell your story and also help others in that situation as well.
Thank you. It's really been a blessing for me to find something that I can do that's productive and hands-on. It's helping me as far as cognitive and physical therapy, and then helping others when we donate to brain cancer research every year too. So it's a win-win all the way around.
Yeah, I agree. Could you tell us about Eliza Pinckney and, you know, how her dying process inspired you?
Yes, Eliza Pinckney, and she didn't actually die. She just was instrumental in the indigo industry. So around 1744, Eliza was a little before that. As a teen, she was living in South Carolina. Her father was a British military officer. And they sent him back to the islands to make sure Spain and France didn't take over the Indies. So he left his teenage daughter in charge of his 5 plantations here. She had one little sister, and she had a mother who was sick in bed most all of the time. And so as a teen, Eliza was supposed to run these plantations, and it was difficult to find ways to keep their plantations afloat, and what product did they have here in the colonies that somebody wanted to buy. So she tried a number of different products, tried growing different things on the plantations, and finally in 1744 was successful in planting indigo seeds and sharing them with neighbors and finding the variety that grew well in our climate. And so she started the gold, what's called the blue gold rush in South Carolina, and indigo became the main export. The British wanted to buy this indigo because it was intense blue, was a little more vivid and long-lasting than the French blues that they'd been buying. And they wanted blues for, we think of the British as the red coat, but they wanted blues. They have all their dress blues, all the fancy uniforms and the ones that the government used. So they, and blue was for royalty, used for their royalty. So we were selling, Eliza was selling indigo cakes, kind of like a bar of soap or a little rectangle from the indigo plant. That's a whole nother story, but indigo is a plant. It's a green plant with pink flowers. And as soon as the pink flowers come, it's time to harvest the indigo. So you harvest the leaves, the green leaves, and those leaves have to go through many, many, many processes, but they eventually they're fermented and the cell walls are crushed, and then the blue dye comes out if you add the proper ingredients. So you need something to feed that fermentation, some kind of a sugar type thing, and then you need something to kind of set the dye. So today, chemicals used are theox and alums and things like that. But back in the day, they used urine in the 1700s, and that set the dye. So anyway, Eliza figured all that out with the immense help of the enslaved people in the area, because they knew they'd been working the fields in the Indies before they came here. So they knew the secret of how do you get this blue dye out of these green leaves? And she helped teach them illegally to read and write. She let them stand in the doorway as she was teaching her little sister. And then they could hear what was going on and figure it out. And so they kind of traded their secrets and their knowledge. And it worked beautifully. If you haven't read Indigo Girl by Natasha Boyd, it's a fabulous story of Eliza Pinckney and the history that it is historical fiction, but it's very accurate historically in how Eliza figured that out and went through the steps and figured out how do we get indigo into cakes and how can we load that on the ships and sell that to the British to keep the colonies afloat. So that worked beautifully until 1776, then things changed a little bit. Yes. British didn't want to really do business with us after that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's a fascinating story. I actually found out this weekend that, you know, how hard it was to get blue coloring because it's not a natural color. Like, you don't see blue naturally anywhere. And most people think, oh, the sky's blue, water's blue, but it's mostly reflections. To actually find blue coloring for clothes, food, anything like that, it's had to be artificially made.
Correct.
So to find natural blue, that's incredible that it is indigo.
Yes.
And the indigo plant. So what is your indigo dyeing process, and how long does it take to create some of the products you sell?
It's a long, long, tedious product, and every person who asks me about it, once I start telling them, they're like, okay, enough. I get it, it's long. So I plant indigo seeds and grow the plant, and then harvest closer to fall. I plant my seeds in March. I harvest in the fall. And I also, then we ferment the leaves and break them down, and then dry the cakes into like a powdery, chalky, the sludge that comes out of it, kind of dry that into a powder. So we have that year round to use in vats. So when you're ready to dye, you have to kind of reconstitute that powder into the water. So the vat preparation works all year. It takes about, it, the process varies greatly depending on the pattern I'm making, or even the item, the textile that I'm making. But average, it's about 8 hours per product. So once you make the vat, then I use all natural indigo. Natural indigo doesn't really want to adhere to polyesters and rayons and those kind of products. You have to have natural products. So it needs to be 100% cotton, flax, linen, silk, those types of fibers. So I have those textiles ready, and we do t-shirts and scarves and headbands and totes and all kinds of products. And those have to be pre-washed and laundered so that there's no residue on them. And then ironed so that they're flat. Then the binding, and that is by far the longest process. Some ways to bind the design in are fairly quick, and others take 8, 10, or 100 hours. Mm. So depends on the design. The super quick ways you may have learned when you did a tie dyeing at summer camp, where you're just using rubber bands or binding with things like that. But what I do is shibori techniques, and that's an old Japanese technique. So it's just resist dyeing, that as long as you can bind the fabric and squeeze it closed tightly in one way or another with sewing thread or clamps or rubber bands or whatever, wherever you can hide, get that fabric so tight that the dye can't get to it, that stays white. And then wherever it's out into the dye will turn blue. So you get your pattern. So the binding can be a tremendous number of hours or fairly quick. Then we dye it with natural indigo. You have to dip it in the dye over and over and over and let it oxidize. It's not how long it's in the water. It's how many times it's dipped in and then taken out to oxidize. So when you have an indigo vat, it looks kind of like the old-fashioned Gatorade, greenish, yellowish. Mm. So you dip that in, hold it under the water, and then when you pull it out, it's lime green. The fabric is just lime green. And then as the air hits it, it begins to oxidize, and it slowly, slowly turns a darker green, a deeper green, and then eventually the blue. It's just like magic every time. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's the most exciting part. And then you let that rest a bit and then unbind it and see your pattern. That's my favorite part, is to see the unbind it. It's like Christmas, unwrapping all the little packages and seeing how the pattern turned out. Then the rinsing begins, and that's forever process, rinsing until the water runs clear and the indigo that didn't sink into the actual cellulose of the fabric needs to be rinsed away. Back in the day when they had old-fashioned jeans, when you get new jeans, you'd rub your hands on the legs, then your hands would get kind of a blue. Mm-hmm. That's called crocking. And that's just a loose indigo dye. It's not going to stain anything. It's just kind of a mess and washes right off. So you have to rinse all that away and then launder and then condition, because the fabric hand is a little bit stiff after the dyeing process. So you use a conditioner on the fabric so it softens up again, and then let it dry, and then iron. That's my least favorite step, is getting all those wrinkles out from the dyeing process, hand ironing each piece. And then, of course, tagging and tagging the goods for what it is and the price and delivery to the stores, which is my husband's job, delivering to the stores. Yeah. So that's kind of the process. And how long does it take? It really depends which one and what you count in the process. But we've figured it's about 8 hours per item.
Yeah, that's awesome. That to hear that you touch every product that goes out and you do it yourself. It says a lot about you and says how strong you are, and that you are able to, still be able to do all this with everything you've went through. And then people still get the product that they love. And then to have that story connected to it is an amazing connection. Where can people purchase these products? Is it mostly off Etsy, or do you have a brick or mortar storefront?
I do not have a brick and mortar storefront. I have the studio at my house where I design everything and go through this whole process. But I do have 4 local stores that handle things for me. The Arsenal, the Beaufort Visitors Center gift shop, has lots of the products. McDonald Marketplace on St. Helena has lots of the products. The Coastal Exchange in Bluffton handles some of the things that we have. And the South Carolina Artisan Center in Walterboro, which is a juried gallery of the top artists in South Carolina, they handle things for me. And then my daughter, Scarlett, handles the Etsy shop under Island Indigo Gal's name. So she's in charge. If you go on Etsy, then you're really talking to her and saying, what do you have and what size? And she ships it and packages it and gets it into the mail, because I can't handle any of that. So she handles that for me. So 5 places: the Arsenal, McDonald's Marketplace, Coastal Exchange, South Carolina Artisan Center, and then Etsy.
This has been a fun episode, Lydia. Thanks for giving us so much insight into your business, your story, and the indigo dyeing process. We really appreciate it. You can go to our website at buefortsc.org/events for more information on upcoming events happening in our area. Thank you for listening to the Intercoastal Podcast. You can follow us on social media at visit_BuefortSC on Instagram or at BuefortSC on Facebook. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review. We'll talk to you all next time.
This has been another episode of the Intercoastal Podcast, hosted by Daquan Mickens and the team at Visit Beaufort, Port Royal, and the Sea Islands, produced by Relic.